Good morning, folks. Clients have asked us if we could just give a broad summary of topics that we have found to be most relevant launching into the beginning of 2012. We'll call the countdown to December 31st, 2012, when there is some expectation that this $5 million gift credit will evaporate, and what people are doing in this new year, and what they're trying to do early in this new year, and what they should be speaking with their financial advisors about right away. So the ideas that we're taking away start with what we've heard from clients, what reporters have reached us on, and then what we've taken away from Heckerling, which is the annual estate planning summit. So first is utilizing term insurance or utilizing insurance as a whole for qualified personal residence trusts and GRATs. So as you know, GRATs and qualified personal residence trusts are two strategies to move assets off your balance sheet and move them into trusts for the benefit of your children and your loved ones. During periods when the gifting credit, the amount you can give away, was $1 million, and again, there is some expectation that that could come back as of next January. It's slated to do that. Clients have used these strategies to compress the value of the asset for a personal residence and get it into trust and allow the children to use, the adults, the givers, to use this asset for a series of years, maybe 15 or 20 years or even longer, and then it would pass to their children at a compressed value, and that was critical. We have clients now that are using the Cuprates even during this $5 million gift exemption period because they have houses that are worth 5 or 10 or more million dollars, so they're using the Cuprate strategy. The key issue with the Cuprate is that if you die before the Cuprate term ends, the asset is clawed back into your estate. And so that work, sadly, means that all the growth and even took place in appreciation in the house and, of course, the asset that was pushed off your estate is clawed back in. There's plenty of things that we've done for you all so that if there is a death, there we can get around some of those, like putting a portion in your name and in your spouse's name, doing multiple tiered grants, or if, after a period of years, at least a portion passes to your children. But the big risk here is that if you pass away, you serve to undermine our work. The second piece is the use of grants. And the strategy with a GRAT is that you put a large block of assets into a trust, and because you have given that away for a period of years, you have to get paid that back. It's almost as if you've made a loan to your children, and they're the beneficiaries, and each year they pay you a portion of that money back, but in the meantime, they've taken that money you've given them and put that to work. In the end, we hope to, quote, zero out that GRAT, which means that if I put $1 million into a trust and for the next 10 years, each year you pay me back one-tenth of that or $100,000 plus interest, the remaining piece continues to be invested, and that money grows and compounds in your children's name or in trust. If you die, however, before that GRAT term ends, all of that growth that would have passed to your children gets clawed back into your estate. So speaking to your financial advisors about using life insurance for both the Cuprate and the GRAT is a wonderful opportunity to provide a hedge. And the hedge says that if I die during this period of years, I know this asset's coming back in and we're going to be subject to estate tax, so I want to buy some life insurance through a separate trust that would serve to inject the cash back into the estate to offset the loss that we had by dying before the term ended. Some clients have said after the grad term has ended that they've said, well, I still like the insurance, and so let's keep it. And they have found out that their insurability issues have changed and the cost of insurance coverage has changed, so they convert their term insurance. Sometimes they buy permanent coverage right up front. We support all of those. We think that every strong, well-thought-through estate plan includes a material component of life insurance, both for the hedge, both for the compounding of assets inside the policy. It runs very similar to a fixed income component of your portfolio. So we see insurance as a wonderful hedge and can also be converted to permanent insurance. So number one, years. Number two, now we're using whole life and annuity contracts has been asset protection. And what can we do to protect ourselves from liability, particularly as there is no, during these periods where there is no confiscatory estate tax below $10 million when there's a husband and wife. We know that's changing, but clients have moved assets out of their name, they've moved assets into their children's name, and so forth. And so they say, well, my child's in a high-risk area. I was with a client that was saying, we're in Wall Street and we have real issues about whether or not we could be sued or requested from financial documents we signed to disgorge our personal assets back. And so the question is, what can you do? Well, we have done a lot of work for clients by setting up trusts offshore. And by offshore, we mean outside the tri-state area. What we typically feel comfort in working with is Delaware, South Dakota, Alaska, and most recently, we've been looking into some other states, and Nevada has become a big one. We think that those are extremely valuable, and they give access to the client of the assets that put her into trust, and we're using partnerships that are created in those areas so that those are also asset protected. But clients have said, are there any other ways without having to necessarily create those vehicles? And the insurance professionals and the financial professionals will tell you for years, we have encouraged clients to put money into tax-deferred vehicles, IRAs, annuities. 2.5 or 3 years ago, the Wall Street Journal published an article that said that, you know, annuities are inferring or implying that are not the annuities that your father drove. And that's correct. Annuities have been a wonderfully powerful and economically advantageous investment vehicle for clients with the returns that they provided, particularly in the depths of the recession, but also life insurance. So the cash that you inject into your life insurance policy to pay for your premiums and also that piece that builds up inside there is another way. So annuities, IRAs, and life insurance are classic typical vehicles that now may be overlooked as everyone is focusing on these other jurisdictions to create vehicles for asset protection. So we want to remind you that these items are asset protected. The classic was when O.J. Simpson, after he won the criminal case, lost the civil case, but he was well advised and he protected his money in his IRA and did not spend it, and that was not an asset that could be forced to be dissolved in bankruptcy, et cetera. So we want you to keep in mind and speak with your advisors about insurance and other financial products as asset-protected vehicles, in addition to exploring, you know, some of these other jurisdictions that many of you we have done that work for. The third item is IRAs and converting to Roth IRAs. And Roth IRAs, as you know, are a IRA that effectively is on steroids. Sorry for using the overused statement. But as you know, you pay the tax instead. So the IRS says, look, here's the plan. You have been contributing money into your tax-deferred vehicle for years. You've enjoyed a tax deduction, and now it's time for you to pay the piper, and you're going to withdraw money from your IRA, and you are going to pay the income tax, and it's going to be based on your life expectancy, and you can start at 59.5, but you, if you don't want to, you definitely have to start by 70.5, and it's been a wonderful savings vehicle. For some clients, they're in a position where they're saying, you know, that was all great, but I don't need my IRA. I don't need to withdraw it. And so they said, do I have any choice? Well, converting to the Roth IRA is more involved. The mechanics is relatively straightforward, but doing an analysis is more involved than what we can review today. It's how much, what happens when you convert. The answer is you have to pay all the tax as if, and there is a schedule where you can stagger it, but if you have a $200,000, let's do it more simply, if a $2 million IRA, effectively you have to pay the tax as if that whole IRA was one distribution to you today. By doing that, you don't have to take it out of your IRA. You can take it out of your other assets. So the estate planning trick here is that if you have a $10 million estate and a $2 million IRA, you are now able to shrink the size of your estate by paying the tax from other assets, but now you have a $2 million IRA that will continue going forward compounding free of tax. Not only do you not have to withdraw it during your lifetime, but your spouse and your children can continue to enjoy the benefits of this without the tax drag. Now, there are some rumors and innuendo that, you know, this deal got better for the super wealthy than anything else, and so there's been some comments, no basis in committees. We've done, you know, we followed this, where they're actually thinking about taxing Roth IRAs. We would think it would be a tremendous dilatory tactic and would be chilling to people who are considering doing IRAs. But down the road, there may be a situation that they would say there could be some tax on some portion. The issue here for us is this strategy your financial advisors have spoken with you in the past about as something to balance. But if you look at it in the current environment and say that income tax rates are going to go up in 2013, and you'll say, well, why? How do we know? If the Republicans get in, maybe they won't raise it. We have a massive debt that's somewhere along the line. They're going to have to raise taxes to pay the piper. The Wall Street Journal just last week was asking us about this planned tax for Medicare in 2013 as part of the Obama health care plan. We know these things are coming. And so is this a good year to realize gains on your stocks? Is this a good year to potentially convert your IRA to a Roth IRA, reduce the size of your estate, pay the tax at a lower potential rate than you would next year? Speak to your advisors about it. We think there's some value. From an estate planning standpoint, we love it because now you're not pulling the money out of the IRA for the rest of your life, and it can pass to your children, and they'll be able to withdraw without any income tax drag. You can also purchase some life insurance there to offset any estate tax that would be due when the IRA passes, not income tax, estate tax. Okay. Next is number four, which is exploring charitable trusts with large IRAs for second marriages. So the strategy here is, and this also can work for first marriages, and we've spoken with many clients in this area, but the second marriage strategy is husband's in, or, you know, the primary breadwinner could be wife or husband, is in their 70s. They have a second spouse who's in maybe their 70s or 60s, and they have children in their late 30s or early 40s. They've got a $2, $3, $4 million, $5 million IRA, and they know that if they leave the IRA in trust to their spouse to capture the federal credit amount, they understand that because it's going in trust, it does not enjoy the rollover power that a typical IRA has. And so then on the spouse's death, the IRA effectively blows up within a short period of time, and it loses its compounding effect. It does do two things. Number one, it ensures that you're capturing a part of your federal credit, and if the credit's $5 million, you're in good shape. Number two is that it goes in trust for the second spouse, but on the second spouse's death, we're assured that it stays in the family and goes to the children from the first marriage. A big component of what the client wants, but not perfect, because the component here is that the children now lose the compounding that the IRA has because it blows up on the spouse's on the surviving spouse's death. So the second piece here is, well, then let's leave it to the wife, the second wife, and then she can roll it over into her name, and then on her promise, the money can pass to the children from the first marriage on her death, and she can roll it over to them, which would assure that the money continues to compound free of tax. The IRA continues to stretch, but you have two risks. The first is that you're counting on your spouse who has no biological connection, and you may be the glue that's keeping your spouse and your children together. When you're not there, the connection ends, and she decides he decides that your children do not need that money. They've gotten enough from their parent from the first marriage. And so they direct it away. So there's real risk that they could direct it away. And we think too great. The second issue is that on the second spouse's death, if there is a lot of assets in that spouse's name, then this IRA will be taxed because there's no more credit left. So our thoughts are to create a charitable remainder trust. And the way that it works well and the way that the formulas come as close as possible is that on your death, you create a charitable remainder trust under your will. And you say, I hereby deposit my $5 million IRA into my charitable trust. You could put a $2 million amount into it, whatever the amount is. And I want an annuity payment to flow back to my spouse. And I want, on my spouse's death, the annuity payments to continue to my children. Now, for the charitable formula to work, the IRS has to know that there's a real opportunity for them to get a remainder after the death of the children or at the end of the term of the trust. So if the children are too young, there'll be too many years that they'll be collecting an annuity, and the IRS says that the charity is not really getting much. So we feel the formula has to be when they're in their late 30s and up into their 40s. So that the charity can feel that there's a real opportunity to get something in the end. But in the meantime, your spouse is enjoying the amount, the annuity amount, and your children, as if this had been rolled over to your spouse and to your children. But your spouse cannot direct it away from the children, and there isn't an estate tax when your spouse dies. The good news here is that on top of that, after the charitable trust ends, we can have a foundation created by you for the benefit of the remaining assets in this charitable trust, where your children and grandchildren, whoever is living at that point, to run it, and that would qualify as a charity for the charitable remainder trust. You'll also talk with your financial advisors about having a one of the typical statutory charities that all major financial institutions have, where you leave the money into a charitable foundation organized by, you know, every financial house, and then you can direct the money by making the request to them to give out to the various charities. Either way, the good news here is that it provides protection. The number five on our list is reintroducing second-to-die life insurance policies. So we have seen our clients not see as much recommendation for second-to-die insurance and to them, and not asking for second-to-die insurance significantly over the past several years, because of the $5 million credit and also this anticipation that the estate tax was going to evaporate altogether. That was during the George Steinbrenner era when he died and there was no tax in 2010. So the notion of the second to die coverage is that this would only pay, this is generally primarily driven to pay for the estate tax. And so we haven't seen or heard as much about it, but as we now get closer to the potential that the estate tax amount goes back to $1 million, if you have a $5 or $6 or $7 million estate, or you have a $35 or $40 million estate, whatever the numbers are, you know, and up, we now have a situation again where we have a real estate tax issue. On a $10 million estate, if the credit goes back to $1 million and husband and wife have each have $1 million, then you'll have eight that will be subject to 55% tax, and you will have on the federal level, and you'll have a 10% tax as well on the state level in the tri-state area, depending on the state. New Jersey, anything over 675, New York, anything over $1 million, Connecticut, anything over two. And I didn't run the full calculation how it works, but the net number is over 50%. So we're telling clients to speak with their financial advisors and address this now because they have risk. They have insurability risk as they get older. They have risk as the cost of coverage is higher. We don't believe that the estate tax is going away. You know, during the end of the Bush era, during the go-go mid-2000s, things were a different set of facts right now. But we believe that the government, irrespective of who gets in, has to pay the piper with this massive amount of borrowing we've done for bailout purposes. And we believe that the estate tax will continue to remain in place. And so we would tell you to look into Second to Die with your financial advisors. Do we think the credit's going to go back to $1 million? We think not. We think that the credit will probably settle at some number higher than that. We're not convinced, by the way, that Congress and the President will get their acting gear by December 31st. We think there's real risk that it goes back to $1 million, the credit, next January, and that they're 6 months before they get their act together into the new year, and they may not make it retroactive. They certainly did not pass the tax bill last year with the $5 million credit and make that retroactive. So there is a risk, we think, that if you died in the middle of 2013, before they passed the bill, and I was at a billionaires conference, and every financial person there raised their hand and said, we don't think Congress will get their act in gear by January 1 of next year, then you have risk that you could pass away during a regime with only a $1 million exemption amount and a 55% tax. We do think they'll settle in the long term. The next item, insurance policies on young children. For years, we have created trust for children and grandchildren for multiple reasons, primarily to hear, and you as our clients have heard us say, to get acorns out of your front yard and put them into trust toss them out of your yard and put them into your children's yard and your grandchildren's yard. Put a fence around it so they don't run them over, but those tiny acorns can grow into mighty oaks. It is a world harder to get those mighty oaks out of your front yard and transplanted into your children and grandchildren. So we say every year, be respectful of this annual exemption amount, guys. And as we're doing our reviews with you all now, clients, you know that we're telling you to make these annual exemption gifts. You can give $13,000 a year to each child. There's many other things we're doing, but this is the most basic. So that amount compounds. Well, we have seen some clients come back to us and say, what if we purchased life insurance on our children and our grandchildren's lives and did that inside this trust? Well, we think it's a great idea. We think it's a great idea because the children are young and their insurability is high. The cost of insurance is cheap. We think my father did this for me. Many years ago, he purchased insurance on my life when I was very young, and then it becomes paid up. Now, if the child dies, the coverage flows into the trust. If the child has children, the proceeds pass free of tax all the way down to the grandchildren. If the child has siblings, the proceeds of the insurance flows into trust for the other siblings, for your children's siblings. So you have this liquidity event, which we think is a wonderful tax-free strategy to get your children off the ground. Now, it also gets them oriented to knowing that insurance and financial planning is a key piece by creating the trust, not just taking small amounts and putting it into your children's trust and investing it. So we encourage you to keep that in mind. Your children can also borrow. So as the trust compounds, and build cash in the years to come, and your children in their 20s, they'll have access to the trust, both as a trustee and a beneficiary, to borrow the cash value from the trust. We hope they pay it back because we think the insurance is a great opportunity for them, but they'll have that that opportunity, even to pay for college from the money. Okay. Number seven, reviewing existing policies. So, down at Heckerling, there was a case. It's been brought up before. It's been brought to my attention by some smart people in the tri-state area. There's one case in particular. It's called the Stewart Cochran case. The issue here is that, and just to keep it simple, is a trustee was considering getting rid of his existing coverage. It was not building cash. It wasn't necessarily a great investment. He went to an independent financial advisor who told him, this is the other choice you should do. It's a better investment. He reduced his insurance by 60% or some significant number, and then the guy went ahead and died. Well, of course, the family was out of their mind, and they said, what on God's green earth were you thinking? And they went to court. And they lost. And the judge said, look, in the end, if you went to your financial advisors and reduced your insurance coverage and you got different coverage and it was a different quality company and so forth, you could potentially have an action against the financial advisor that told you to reduce the coverage. In the end, though, the financial advisor was saying, look, this is better coverage. This is a more high-quality company. And it was sound advice that he died is sad and you got significantly less. And the judge then referred to the fact that they sought the advice from an independent party. The case did not go to the highest court. It was a low trial court. It hasn't been referred to by any other case in the state of Indiana, and we have not seen any other state refer to this case as well. But what it does say is that when you have insurance inside a trust and you all clients have trustees, your spouse, your sibling, your children serving, there is some modest fiduciary duty there, and we want you to have either on their behalf or on your own review the coverage that you have. Your financial advisors want you to do that as well. So that they're seeing the performances of the policies. They should look at the total group of policies. We're happy to support you when you raise your hand and tell your advisors this. But it is a strong situation that we encourage you to do, because now you have built this fiduciary vehicle to save tons of estate tax and to be asset protected all the way down to your children and grandchildren. But in holding insurance, the fiduciary has to make sure that the products inside, even though the fiduciary didn't buy them necessarily or wasn't the one searching them out, could have some risk. We think it's modest, but we think the prudent plan is to review your coverage with your advisors as quickly as you can. Lines of credit. So we have clients that have a house that's worth, you know, for this discussion, you guys all know who you are on the call, but you have a $5 million house, and it's worth, you paid $800,000 for it many, many years ago. If you give that house away, and there's a whole host of reasons why most of our clients are leading with this strategy, particularly if they're in good health, most of you, we'll put it into a trust right now because you'll say that house is at the lowest value and it's going to grow from $5 million to $10 in the next 20 years. I think that if you look back at what your house is worth today and look back 20 years, you'll see that you've gotten at least a double, even in this real estate. And we, in this market, with all the pullback, we have seen our clients get a double from the early 90s. So if you've got another 20 years with this real estate, it could continue to compound as the markets recover. And so we do encourage it as a great strategy to get it out of your name. We talked before, though, about certain strategies require that you live a long life. And so for clients who are elderly, for all of you who have siblings, or if we haven't spoken and there is some news, you and you're ill, it is very important to consider moving assets out of your name during this period of time. So if you have a $5 million house for this discussion and you paid $800,000, by getting it out of your name, you are reducing the size of your estate, and that's critical. And if the house, if you continue to live, the house grows in your children's name. If it's in trust, which we recommend, it's protected in the event that they die or divorce, that's a single value. But what if we're in a rush? Okay, what if we don't know the health situation? And also be mindful that if you move assets out of your name today, you're also avoiding state estate tax. There's still a little bit of a clawback, but if you have a $5 million asset and you move it out of your name today, you'll avoid state estate tax on anything over $1 million. It's not exactly precise. There is a little bit of a form of the clawback, a little bit, but there's $400,000 worth of tax on the state level you avoid by pushing that out of your name. That's the good news. The bad news is that the $800,000 original purchase price carries over to your children, and so when your children sell the house, they pay the gain back to the $800,000. Now, in a long-term strategy, it is always extremely valuable to still give the asset away and to still employ structures. But if you're at the end, the value here is to keep these low basis assets in your name, because when you die, the IRS says we'll give you a step up, which means the $5 million house then gets the basis, gets reset to $5 million. And that means that, surprise, when your kids sell it, they don't pay any gains tax, and that rate could be 15 to 20%. But they could be paying estate tax at 30 or 40% with state and federal, depending on where the rates are. So here's how the strategy goes for a urgent end-of-life situation. Here what you do is you take your $5 million house and you go out and you get a $2, $3, $4 million line of credit against the house. And you'll have to speak with your financial advisors and see what they can do for you. Today rates are extremely low because you have money managed with them. You often will get favorable rates. They'll take a mortgage against it. But let's say you could get a $2 or $3 million mortgage on your $5 million house. Well, what you do then is you take that money, that cash, and you gift that in trust to your kids. Now you've gotten $4 million out of your name, and there isn't any low basis issue. It's not as if you cash doesn't have any basis problem. And you've kept the house in your name, and so when you die, the house gets reset up to $5 million, but the house is subject to a mortgage. So $3 million of mortgage means the total value of the house is only worth, for estate tax purposes, $2 million, and you've saved all that estate tax. Plus, the house got the reset on the basis, and so when the kids sell it, you have this phenomenal opportunity to save on that tax. It is a fabulous opportunity when you're in a rush, and your hop to it financial advisors can put that together. I would tell you right now to go out and speak to your financial advisors, even when you're in good health, for property that does not have a mortgage, and talk to them about what they can do, even if they put together a line of credit available for you, so that if, God forbid, we need it, we can use that and pay it down. Okay. Next strategy, transferring large cash value policy, whole life policies into trust with retaining access for the insured. So for years, we've always, in the past, two plus years, or rather leading up to the past two plus years, Clients have often, you all have always considered using life insurance as a fixed income component for your investment portfolio, to add to your bond portfolio and your equities and all of your other atypical investments, hedge funds, private equity, et cetera. So we know that this life insurance often has a big death benefit, but the cash is built up as well. So we will often see with you all that we'll have $5 or $10 million worth of coverage, maybe more, 20, and there'll be $2, $3 million, $4 million of cash built up. So you have said, look, I don't want to put that in trust because I want the access to the cash. And that has been a reasonable and sound issue. The other reason you haven't put it into trust is because if you transfer it in, you've been limited to only $1 million. So we've had to come up with some strategies to get past that. During this period, we have the $5 million exemption amount. We want you to talk to your advisors about taking your $5 million or your cash value, that could be $500,000 to several million, and transferring it into trust, because now you're getting the compounding of not just the cash going into the trust, but the ultimate death benefit, which could be $5, $10, $15, $20 million, certainly a multiple of what the cash is in there. So there's a very good reason why you would want to do that. But you and your financial advisors may say, well, we're surrendering access to the cash. Well, today we're able to, and these are things that we've discussed, in the last quarter down at Heckerling with our colleagues, and we've been doing this for many years as well, is building trust where you can borrow from that trust. It's called a defective trust. You've heard it all. We've been using it for years. But using the defective trust as a strategy to hold your life insurance. So now you put the $5 million of cash in with a $15 million death benefit in this hypothetical, and any number works, $500,000 with a $2.5 million death benefit. You put it in, but you can take comfort that you can still borrow and have access to that cash, and it's not included in your estate. It is excluded under the code sections. So I want to encourage you to look to defective trust to hold the coverage. Okay, which brings me to my last point of the topic, and this is decanting trusts enabled to making gift tax purchases. So many of you who are on the call know over the past couple of years we've done some great work to enable you in your life insurance trust to buy significantly greater death benefit policies which have significantly higher premiums than they otherwise would. So in the old days, you would, your insurance advisors would come to us and financial advisors and say, look, we can only do a $2.5 million death benefit, Mr. McManus, because the annual premiums are $40,000 and with the two children and the spouse, annual exemption amount is only $40,000. And that made us sad because clearly the client and the advisor and I supported more coverage. So we started to employ a strategy which enabled us to increase the amount of beneficiaries called Cristofani beneficiaries. And without getting into the detail of that or any of the other topics here, the idea is to add beneficiaries in addition to your children to give them notice and also to give them a thin linear slice of the death benefit. So, you know, I have three children. That allows me $78,000 worth of gifting per year in my life insurance trust, but maybe my premiums are $120,000. So I add my niece and nephew, and I give them 2% of the trust, and therefore I can increase the premium amount. If I have grandchildren, I can include them as well. If I have whoever, all of you have your situation, but your old trust may not address that. So you can now talk to your advisors and say that we can decant. And this is a word that my office uses a lot, and I never got it until finally one of the smart guys on the team said, it's like decanting your wine. You're pouring from the bottle into the decanter on your dining room table for Thanksgiving, and letting it breathe while we're pouring the existing assets in the trust into a new trust that allows for these additional beneficiaries and then allows you to buy more coverage and you're not constrained with gift tax issues. The second big thing that we're doing is we're allowing the trust now for the children to be lifetime trusts because we believe for sure that the amount of gifts that are passing to children and grandchildren is so significant that we want to protect that from second spouses, from spouses, from your children, and if they die or if they're in some kind of liability. So the use of decanting trusts is a significant part of what we're doing for clients who have some coverage, and now they want to buy more, but they want to keep it in the same trust. New York, and I was on the committee for the bar when we drafted this legislation more than 10 years ago that allowed New York to, quote, decant trust. But what we've taken away from Heckerling this year is that strongly that even in states that don't allow, statutorily provide for it, if your trust allows you to decant, then you can. And good news, we've been thinking about this for a decade ourselves, waiting for the other states to come along. And so our trusts do allow for decanting. So we can make those revisions or create this trust that will allow us to pour the existing insurance and then allow you to buy more coverage. And we look forward to hearing from you. Good luck speaking with your financial advisors who are looking out for you. Take care.